You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest today is Kelly Clancy, who is a neuroscientist and physicist who has held research positions at MIT, University of California, Berkeley, University College London, and the AI company DeepMind. Her new book is called Playing with Reality: How Games Have Shaped Our World. Love the book. Love the conversation. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock.
Kelly Clancy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You tell a story about a game that I know as the Philosopher's Game, but it was also called Rhythmomachia. I think I said that maybe close to being right.
Yeah.
A game historically credited to Pythagoras in the 5th century BC. So I want you to tell us about the game, and because you call it, quote, one of the most absurd cover-ups in intellectual history. So I'd like to know, tell us about it.
So this was a game that it was credited to the mathematician Pythagoras, but it really seems to have come around more like who lived at like 400 BC, I think. The game seems to have come out around 1000 AD, and mm-hmm. it was used by monks to train math, teach math to their students. Mm-hmm. It is kind of like chess in that it is a kind of capture game where the pieces are trying, the players are trying to capture each other's pieces. But unlike chess, there's numbers on the pieces. And the idea is the players are trying to arrange the pieces with numbers on them in particular patterns, like geometric progressions, in order to win. So it's basically a number theory game where you have to kind of know certain mathematical ideas. And it was created to teach the ideas of Pythagoras, who was this mathematician, a Greek mathematician who had a cult, a math cult. So he believed that all of the universe was founded on numbers. That, like he said, his famous quote is all is number. So the whole universe kind of unfolds from numbers. And some of his proof of this was things like he had discovered that strings, when plucked, have a particular note. And if the string is plucked with another string that's like twice its length, they tend to be in harmony. So the idea mm-hmm. that like harmonic notes are kind of multiples of each other as whatever. So he had this obsession with numbers, but he really was only largely obsessed with what's known as rational numbers, which are mm-hmm. numbers like 1 and 2 and 1/2. So like easy fractions like that, 1/3. And it turned out that a mathematician, a member of his cult, discovered this other kind of number known as the irrational number, which are mm-hmm. numbers like pi, numbers that are decimals that don't repeat. So they're kind of like unknowable. Like if you want to know the 100th digit of pi, you have to just calculate out to the 100th digit. So this mathematician discovered this other universe of numbers. And because it didn't really fit with Pythagoras's ideas, his cult apparently had him drowned in the sea for his incredible discovery of this naughty, irrational universe. Pythagoras also was a strict vegetarian, and the cult was also vegetarian, but they weren't allowed to eat beans because Pythagoras believed that beans were like human fetuses and that they might house human souls because they kind of have like a shape of fetuses. So he forbade his cult from eating beans, and he considered beans this kind of like sacred human-like plant. And the cult lived for many decades in Croton, a colony of Greece, until his, you know, Pythagoras got so powerful that the kind of local leaders became jealous of him, and they set fire to the compound and forced Pythagoras out of his house. And apparently, according to one story, he was fleeing from these hooligans when he came upon a field of beans, and he was he was afraid of treading on the beans because they're sacred, and so he stopped in his tracks, and then the hooligans caught up with him and killed him. So Pythagoras had this profound impact on the entire educational system and mathematics of that time. He was extremely influential. His cult lived on for hundreds more years, and his ideas lived on even longer than that. And the existence of rational numbers really didn't make it out of Europe. It was really kind of brushed under the rug because they didn't accord with Pythagoras's ideas, and so they didn't exist. And now we know that irrational numbers are kind of like the biggest numbers around. They're like, there's much more of them than there are of rational numbers. But in any case, this game, Rhythmomachia, or the philosopher's game, was used by monks to teach students the ideas of Pythagoras and these kind of progressions, these geometric or arithmetic progressions of rational numbers. And as a result, it's thought that this program, this mathematical program, kind of held European scholarship back for hundreds of years, because Europeans were being so inculcated with these kind of idealistic ideas of numbers that we didn't expand into more interesting realms. And I think the introduction of mathematics from India and the Arabic world really kind of reinvigorated European mathematics.
So as wild as that story is and seems, I think the adage, a tale as old as time, applies here, because it just keeps happening as you tell the story, whether we go into game theory and war games. And before we start discussing that, I'm curious about, look, you know, you and I both played games as kids, of course, you know, we all did. But clearly, both you and I have maybe a slightly obsessive interest in games, and I will tell you where mine came from. And it wasn't necessarily sports, though that was a big part for me, but it was when I got to work at Second City, and the foundation of everything we do are these improv games that were created by a social worker, Viola Spolin, in the 20s and 30s to better assimilate the immigrant children coming into her care. And then they also produce incredible comedy, but they are the thing that trained everyone from Mike Nichols and Elaine May to Stephen Colbert and Tina Fey, that made them so good at what they do. And so this, and we're so, we always think about the games, and there's things called like Game of the Scene. And, you know, so we play games and we make money at playing these theater games. So that's the world I come from. I don't know that neuroscience is rife with games. Maybe it is.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that it's actually hard. It's been hard for neuroscientists to study play because it's such a deeply ingrained behavior. First of all, it's like evolutionarily ancient. Most mammals play, you know, reptiles, birds, fish even play. There's some evidence that like insects play, bees play. So it's all over the animal kingdom, and it's really hard to cut it out because, decades ago, scientists did this experiment where they surgically removed the cortex of baby rats. So this is the part of the brain that we think of as being responsible for higher intelligence. So they cut it out and the rats grew up still playing. So it's one of these behaviors that is just so innate and so strong. So it's actually, you know, quite hard to study. And I think I was partly drawn to the study of games in part because I was working at DeepMind when I started this book, which is like the AI company known for creating computer programs that bested human champions at games like Go. And I was also, it was also kind of COVID lockdowns, and I was rediscovering video games as a way to pass the time and having a great time. And I was like, wow, games are incredibly captivating. And businesses are spending like hundreds of millions of dollars just to make programs to play them. Like, what is so interesting about games? Why are we so fascinated? Why is there such a, like, a, such a long history throughout evolution, throughout human history, of this obsession with games? And even though I think they're often trivialized and kind of seen as like unimportant, they, the more I looked into it, the more I realized they really underpin the basis of kind of how we see the world and how we move in the world. And even if you don't play games as an adult, the games you played as children really set up a lot of your social circuits and like how you see the world and how you interact with people. Like they, the, one of the best studies of game, like neuroscience studies of games. So it turns out that rats laugh, and you know, this is great because we diverged from them like 75 million years ago, but we still both laugh. And so, and much like human laughter, it's like a contagious emotion for rats. So when one rat laughs, all the other rats stop what they're doing and come play together and laugh together. But if a rat is born deaf, it cannot hear the laughter of its peers. And so it grows up playing substantially less than it's like hearing litter mates. And those rats grow up to be socially awkward, unable to read social cues, less likely to mate, more aggressive, all kinds of like kind of tragic social deficits.
Because
he didn't play. And so we really can see that play is this really important social bonding activity. It's maybe partly about learning about the world, but it's even more, I think, learning about each other.
When corporations hire us to come in, I think they often think we're going to do role playing because we're a theater. And what we actually do is we say, no, what we're going to focus on is these games, these exercises, and we have to call them exercises often because they don't want to buy games. It's like we're selling play. We don't call it play. But, you know, and the games are listening games sometimes, you know, and so it's like, it's simply, I'll give you an example. So we have a game called Last Word, and you get two people together and you have a conversation, and there's one rule. You have to begin your sentence with the last word the other person said. It simply requires you to listen to the end of a sentence. And then we talk about it afterwards in terms of what did that feel like, and how did you try to game the system? Did you, you know, because there's no other rule that we gave you. And so when someone's saying, well, it was hard for me to respond, I was like, all you had to say was orange and then go and say whatever you wanted to say. We didn't give you that. You were imposing your own sort of rules on that. And inside that deconstruction of the game is exactly, I think, what you're talking about, which is the way human beings behave, think, decide, react, and many of which are, of course, unconscious, because we're dealing with our shortcuts. But it is in the embodied play where we can actually get some learning done with these folks.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's amazing how much kind of baggage we bring into games and how much unspoken assumption comes into the way we play games. There's a famous psychology experiment where they are playing a game that's famously called, it's got a structure named the Prisoner's Dilemma, which is basically a game where the idea is like there are two prisoners jailed separately, and they have to decide whether they're going to cooperate and stay silent about a crime they committed together or betray one another. The benefit and cost of their decision whether to cooperate or betray each other depends on what the other person does. So if they both cooperate, it's best. They both spend a year in jail. If one betrays the other, but the other stays silent, the one who betrays the other doesn't go to jail, gets out free. And the one who stays silent has to be in jail for like 2 years. And then if they both betray one another, they're in jail for like 2 years, let's say. The idea is that like, if you want to be selfish, you should betray the other person. But if both people betray each other, then they both have to be in jail for 2 years. If they just cooperated, they would be in jail for 1 year. So the idea is that by acting selfishly, you actually kind of do the worst. And psychologists can put people in this kind of game structure in like laboratory experiments. And actually, naively, most people cooperate. Like, we tend to be like very social animals. But interestingly, if the psychologist calls it the game a different name, so if they call it the Wall Street game, the players tend to betray one another. Like 70% of the people betray one another. If they call it community, 70% of the players cooperate. So literally the exact same game, just a different name, a different title for the game, completely changes how people behave within the game.
What I love about that is this thing that doesn't come up nearly enough, which, especially in the social sciences, which is, but the context can change.
Yeah.
It's like that. That is so, and for our work, the thing about Spolin, who invented the improv games, is she talks all about the point of focus of an exercise. And when you change the point of focus of an exercise, it changes the learning, and it changes the exercise and the experience of the exercise and the learning. Because we live in this world that is populated by lots of different people and lots of different things at lots of different times. So I can behave like this. And you talk about this within your work, which is this assumption, A, that we had that people all behave rationally, but also this assumption that they're making a decision maybe just based on self-interest, or why not be a self-interested decision that can work out for everyone? You know, that's hard thinking, and not a thing that people talk about a lot.
Right. And it's really kind of tragic that this idea that comes from game theory, which is that people are ultimately totally selfish, self-interested decision makers, is A, not at all supported by the psychological evidence. And it's not even really supported by game theory, because game theory is not a model of people. It's just it's like a series of mathematical equations. So it's a kind of bizarre thing that we've brought this notion that we're all selfish into the world, because it has then kind of been used to justify selfish behaviors. And the idea that that true self-interest is only concerned about oneself. I mean, if you look at, like, for example, the evolution of altruism in nature, when scientists have studied the biology of this, altruism emerged because it can benefit the person who's being altruistic, or the animal is being altruistic. It's not just about like, oh, I'm being selfless. Like, you can be selfless and get something out of it, which, you know, some people say that's not really altruism, but I don't see why altruism can't work for everyone. It's just this idea that we should do away with kind of mutual self-regard, this like traditional values, seems kind of bonkers to me.
Well, isn't it also related to the fact that, like, as human beings, we really just want to be one thing. We just want right or wrong. We just want black or white. We just that, like, please make it easy for me, because it's so, and it is hard. It's always hard. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, that's totally right. And actually, game theory kind of came at a time, kind of evolved at a time right after World War II, when we now had nuclear weapons and people were terrified. The entire state of war changed, because now the course of history could change in hours. You know, the decisions had to be made so much more quickly than traditionally in the military, where we would be waiting for like troops to move over land by foot for like months. Now it was like war could happen at any moment and decisions would have to be made lightning fast. And so the military adopted game theoretic thinking as this kind of abdication of like moral responsibility, where, okay, I didn't make this decision. This is just the cold, hard facts. Like, this is the way it is, and the math backs it, even though it's, again, not the way anything is, because it's not really a model of how people work.
It's interesting. When I started working with the academic community around our work, I realized that the really the only robust studies of improvisation came from two sources. One was natural disasters, so post like Haiti, Fukushima. And the other was Carl Weick, who's a professor emeritus at the University of Michigan, which was studying the improvisational nature on aircraft carriers. So the kind of split second way and people have to pivot and improvise to make sure that so my point being, and your point, which is these games are not minor in any way. And one of the things I thought was fascinating, which is a whole other pivot on this, but that's kind of the same thing, was the amount of deaths and around gambling addictions as opposed to alcoholism. Can you talk about that? Because that was a stunning observation.
Yeah. So gambling addiction is, it's hard to get like hard numbers on I think any of these things, but globally it impacts something like 1%, maybe even up to 3% of people globally. Alcoholism globally apparently only affects 1% of population, but this is again including like, you know, Muslim countries where people tend to not drink. You know, in a country like America, I think it's more like maybe 10%. But gambling addiction is actually a really serious problem for a lot of people. And in fact, it has the sort of highest suicide rate of any group struggling with addictions, in part because it's so stigmatized.
We have an enemy of the podcast, and I interview people from across, you know, all kinds of different sciences and all different kinds of disciplines. But man, oh man, Milton Friedman comes up again and again and again. And right in our backyard at the University of Chicago, where Second City was founded, you know.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But it's again this game around, I mean, essentially what became trickle down economics, right? Can you speak a little bit about what that particular lie?
Yeah. The University of Chicago is kind of like the Death Star of economics, like it's like the most like evil people. So trickle down economics is kind of the ultimate kind of theoretical underpinning is this idea of what you could call like a maxi-max strategy. So a mini-max strategy is what game theory kind of predicts would be an equilibrium solution. So like something that like any player should play because it will always kind of minimize their potential losses no matter what the other player does. And so an example of a game that we could look at as like a mini-max versus maxi-max is this like age-old parenting trick of cutting a cookie, like having cutting a cookie between two kids. So the parent will give one kid the knife and say, you cut it. And then the other kid chooses which half they get first. So this really incentivizes the first kid to cut the cookie as evenly as possible. So that, because they know that realistically the other kid is going to take the bigger half.
Yep.
So a maxi-max strategy is what's known as like a naive strategy, where it's often like used by kids who don't really know any better yet, or like just naive players. And so that would look like the first kid cutting a little sliver out of the cookie and then hoping the other kid picks this little sliver so that they get the big remaining chunk of the cookie. And that's kind of what the idea behind trickle down economics, where it's like, people are just going to naturally give back and it's just going to naturally arise. And honestly, the amazing thing about the ideas of Milton Friedman, they have incredible purchase in economics, in academia across the world. A lot of, you know, everyday people think this is like really great stuff. And this is not necessarily because the ideas were academically that great. There was like a huge PR campaign waged by General Electric to make the ideas of Friedman and Ayn Rand and other kind of conservative thinkers accepted worldwide. So there were like think tanks that would buy millions of copies of the books to give them out for free. General Electric had this TV show called General Electric Theater, which was eventually kind of hosted by Ronald Reagan, who at the time was a New Deal Democrat, but kind of adopted the precepts of his anti-union employers over time and became this hero of conservative thinking. It's really this kind of amazing PR campaign for like really kind of dumb ideas.
Yeah, and this is where you know Goodhart's law, which is when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. And like that, I always say a short version of like the incentives are bad.
Yeah,
the incentives are so terrible.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So a thing I don't always do this, but like I take copious notes. I always read all the book. And then I put in bold some questions I have to ask you because they were just passages. So they might feel like they come out of nowhere, but I don't want to not get to them.
Okay.
So one of those was, quote, practically speaking, economic welfare is most often measured in terms like GDP, wages, or savings. It becomes a system insensitive to everything except what can be quantified in dollars. It cannot, for instance, register human misery, save what can be profited by it, end quote. That's a powerful sentence, and it makes me think of caregiving.
Yeah, the kind of one of the tragedies of game theory is that its advocates say, well, it can include any preference. It can theoretically include that humans are social, that we care about each other, that we want to be honest. You know, all of these kind of traditional human values theoretically could be included in the math of game theory. But in practice, this never happens. We basically use, economists use money or GDP to measure all kind of economic output. And, you know, it's amazing. There's this idea that a perfectly, like an unregulated market will be to work most efficiently. But this is only in the sense that a unregulated market will create the biggest surplus, like the biggest extra money. And economists labeled that as social welfare. So they said, oh, this surplus will be social welfare. There's nothing in the models or nothing in the math that suggests that would actually go back to any people. That money, you know, in unregulated markets always trickles up to the top. So there's this amazing sleight of hand that happens where, you know, oh, well, theoretically, we could include these values and these human preferences. But in practice, it's all kind of, you know, it's all kind of waved away.
There's another one here. And I was reading this book in my garden. And sometimes I'll sort of switch between that and go on social media just to like abuse myself.
Seriously.
Like, what am I doing? Yeah. And indeed, I put the book down and someone was taking shots at Second City over something on social media that they completely got wrong. Just to be mad. And I actually put this up on my feed, which no one noticed or commented on, unfortunately, but because I thought it spoke to it, which is, quote, the internet has revealed just how plastic our preferences are. People can be radicalized by consuming progressively extreme content. Because social media has been effectively gamified, people may be socially rewarded for adopting stances that garner them attention or approval from niche communities. They may adopt beliefs about the world not because they reflect reality, but because they are reinforced by social rewards like community status. Plainly false ideas can go on to have real social and political repercussions if they attract enough devotees. Take QAnon, for example, end quote. And yeah. and not even just as extreme as QAnon, about anything, any issue of any day.
Absolutely. There's, I read this after I wrote the book, but there's an amazing quote from Kurt Vonnegut that I'll have to paraphrase, but it's something like, the reason Americans have no natural immunity to cuckoo ideas is that ideas have become sort of badges of social alignment. They're, you know, you're friends with people who have the same ideas of you and enemies of people who have different ideas. It's this idea that, you know, we pledge allegiance to ideas because we are socially, or we're pledging ourselves socially to particular groups. So there's nothing about truth to ideas. Like there's, I think maybe, you know, scientists might find truth of ideas rewarding because of the way that they kind of like the way their internal value system is set up. But for the average person, our internal value systems, like, it doesn't really reward truth. We're rewarded by, because we're fit in with people, people who have trouble feeling academically listened to will then maybe go off and create a flat world conspiracy because there's going to be other people who reward them for thinking differently. It's got everything to do with how we're rewarded, whether it's like socially or like internal values, and not really anything to do with like veracity in the world. And I think that's something that I still have trouble accepting, because there's still this really strong belief in me and probably in a lot of people that like truth matters, that we are ultimately guided by and interested in the truth. And it's really just amazing when you look at the literature, how much our beliefs are social agreements, really.
Yeah. But I also think both things can be true.
I totally agree.
Right. So and to that point, you know, you're taking some shots at my friends. I mean, I had a 4 or 5 year program at the University of Chicago with Richard Thaler and others, with all the behavioral scientists. But I was very, you know, in improv, we say replace blame with curiosity. So it's like always in that mindset of like, well, let me listen to this. And it's really interesting. And it doesn't, and I know Richard Thaler loves to engage in these arguments. He's like, he is a playful human being. He plays games. He's interested and would probably react to the stuff in that way. So it's just so, it is so crucially important, I think, to recognize that we might be making or hold this position for a bunch of other reasons that could as much have to do with who our parents were and where we grew up as it was of what we ate this morning. And all of that is fine. And that doesn't mean you need to like be drowning in existential despair. Like, and that's the great thing about games. They allow us to practice all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a really important point, is like, we're also in this point of human culture where we can explore cuckoo ideas. Like, who ever thought to go to the moon? Like, it's, none of this has to do with any existential need of human. I mean, maybe eventually if we're like, if we run out of space on Earth, but like, it's purely curiosity and play driven. And that's the beauty of human culture. And, you know, this deep urge we have to play.
So my wife Ann and I have worked at Second City for over, I'm 36 years, she's 38 years. And so we've seen a lot. And she has a theory about the sort of politics of working here, which is the only way to win at Second City is not to play. And this has been proven out time and time again. And I thought about it when you talk about Stefan Zweig, who wrote Chess Story in 1941, can you talk about that?
Yeah. So Zweig was a famous German author who fled Europe, you know, as Hitler rose to power, and was actually quite paranoid that the Germans would take over the world. And so he first fled to Britain and then felt like he wasn't, you know, far enough away from the Germans, and then ultimately fled to Brazil, where he lived out his last year in a kind of remote jungle town with his young wife. And ultimately, they've committed suicide together, in part because of this isolation. His last novella was known as called The Chess Game, either Chess or there's a lot of different names for it. But he writes about a young, a young man who was imprisoned by the Gestapo, and is, you know, held captive in a hotel room for months on end and interrogated, because this man was a, you know, financial planner for a bunch of like high rich people, and they were trying to find his money. So anyway, they imprison him for months and torture him, and he's kind of held in solitary confinement. And the one solace he has is he manages to steal a book of chess games, like a chess moves, from one of the guards. And so he learns chess and then learns that he can play chess against himself in his head. So he kind of like divides his consciousness in order to be able to play himself, and gets incredibly good at it in this manner. And it's how he kind of escapes the drudgery of his solitary confinement. You know, he eventually goes mad because of this, and is let go because they realize he's not going to have any useful information for them. And years later, finds himself, I think, on like a cruise with a international chess champion who is, you know, technically very good at the game, but not particularly like interesting or erudite. The young man in the game plays against this chess master, because other, other people on the boat kind of encourage him. I think he wins the first game, and then this chess master in the second game starts to realize that the longer he takes to make his moves, the kind of more frantic and the more frantic that this Dr. B gets, because Dr. B is kind of like running in his head all of the possible moves and just like kind of branching out, and eventually he kind of has to stop playing the game and forfeits because he realizes like he's just kind of driving himself crazy by playing this game. Yeah. And it doesn't really matter, you know, to prove to himself that he is as good as a chess master ultimately is not worth losing his sacrificing his mental health. So yeah, the idea is kind of, and this is actually a kind of common conceit in a lot of game analyses, is that sometimes the best move is to not play, to just walk away and not involve yourself.
Yeah, and I think that Anne's analogy for Second City is actually, I think, true of many people in their jobs, which is at a certain point, you have to realize that if this has become a game that will do that to you, why are you playing?
Exactly.
Play a better game.
Exactly. And
there's
also just be,
play.
Yeah, and be aware of what games you're playing. Because I know a lot of people in jobs where, you know, they are like, okay, well, you know, if I do this, this should be grounds for promotion, or this should be like how I get ahead. But really the actual rules are something completely different. Like, for example, at Google, it's famous for having what's known as the Google graveyard, like projects, programs that they started building out, you know, like Google Plus, and then were like pretty quickly done away with. And the reason that happens so much with Google is that at Google, people are promoted for starting new projects and not for maintaining them. And so these kinds of like the way that a business works is going to dictate how the employees operate and therefore the products that come out of it. And so being thoughtful about, you know, how are we actually rewarding people for the work they do and what work are we rewarding? And then also for employees to be like, okay, well, I'm just not, you know, if I don't need to maintain it to get promoted, then I'm not gonna, you know, just play the game as it stands and don't try to like, be a hero, I guess.
I do a lot of keynotes for organizations, and I've been doing a thing lately where I say, all right, everybody raise your hand if you've worked in a workplace that you would call functional. Right? No one raises their hand.
Wow.
Of course they don't. Have you?
No.
I haven't.
No.
So, and that's, I think that relates to this idea of chance and randomness that you talk about, which is you just can't account for things like chance and randomness. How important is that in this game, which is then a model for how we understand the world, which, by the way, fantastic analogy, because also that's what the theater is.
Yes.
That's why plays happened. That's why music happened. That's why art happened.
Yes.
So talk about a bit about the randomness, because that is a thing that you over and over again with people in the war games and the other things that they just don't seem to take into account.
Oh, yeah. So, randomness is this like really powerful kind of search strategy where, for example, an anthropologist was trying to work out why so many cultures have forms of witchcraft or divination. He's like, well, famously, divination doesn't really work. Why do people seem to do it all the time? And it turns out he reasoned that the reason we do this is that it helps to de-bias our behavior. So for example, this tribe of Innu in Labrador would plan their hunts using scapulomancy. They would kind of look at the cracks and bones and decide where to hunt that way. And that way they're not like, okay, they're not like using biased decisions where they're like, okay, I've seen deer over there before, so I'm going to keep going there. It forces them into a random situation that they've not been before. And it, therefore, the hunters are not as predictable to the animals. And it's this really powerful tool for search. And this is also true, like it's employed in machine learning algorithms to kind of kick the solutions out of little ruts and things. So randomness is this really important role, has this important role in human decision making and animal decision making, but it's also it's something that we can't really model very well. And the way that we eventually came to models of randomness was through games, through gambling and dice. And mathematicians, Blaise Pascal and Pierre de Fermat, worked out the early mathematics of probability theory by thinking about dice. And this has been really transformative for the world, because previously all of these things in the world were kind of credited to God. So like dice were actually literally thought to be kind of like the mouthpieces of God. Like the unknowability of dice was kind of likened to the unknowability of God's will. And so people would try to kind of augur God's will through dice. And actually the word clergy comes from the Greek word kleros, which means chance. So it was like only the clergy could talk to God through these instruments of like dice and lots. So we have a long history of using randomness to make decisions, because there's also, you know, there's a certain kind of fairness in dice. But also the randomness of dice are not really indicative of how randomness works in the real world. Like the randomness of dice is kind of like less random in a way. It's more orderly. It's doesn't have these like big shocks. And so the fact that we often use statistics that describe dice to describe events in the real world is actually, it sounds like a theoretical problem, but it's actually practically really significant and probably underpins like, you know, the scientific replication crisis, where a lot of scientists are publishing statistics, you know, publishing studies using the wrong statistics that make make outcomes seem more significant than they are. And it was also maybe responsible for like the 2009 financial crisis. So all these like incorrect models of risk and statistics are materially impacting our world.
We have an exercise that we do. And for us, it's about getting people to understand divergent thinking, and it's called point and untell. So you basically take someone's hand in pairs, you walk around a room and you point at an object, and the other person's job is to say what it isn't. That's the only thing. They just can't. If it's a blue ball, they can't say blue ball. They have to say something else. And it's hard. It's tough. Yeah. And so that, but then again, why is it tough? And, and you're like, oh, and so understanding that upsetting your own patterns, man, it's why habit is so tough. And I'm, you know, like it just is, because you were used to doing it a certain way. All right. We're going to have you tell us your yes and story, but I have one more thing. So a lot of books I read tell the same stories, whether they're business books or other books, that like there's just a bunch of great stories that get refashioned. I have never heard the Nolan Bushnell who founded Atari. You know why I'm asking you this.
Yeah.
So he turned down Apple, who offered him shares, right, in Atari. Yeah. So this is Pong, which was my first video game. Oh, cool. We had Pong. Yeah.
Nice.
Why did he turn him down? What did he want to focus on?
So Nolan Bushnell was approached by the two, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, to have a third of the company, Apple, that they were leaving Atari to found. And he was at the time solely focused on his next venture, which was Chuck E. Cheese. So he was giving up Atari because he had this new vision that the way to bring in new customers to the world of games was getting kids in early. And he thought Chuck E. Cheese was going to be the way that we brought video games to the masses. Mm-hmm. And he has a quote, something like, you know, whether it's the, you know, time of Roman gladiators, you know, all humans are, want to be entertained. They want spectacle. And so he found an animatronics engineer to make these incredible robot band and installed these arcade games for kids to play. And it's actually quite tragic, because I think he ended up getting stabbed in the back by one of his co-founders, who absconded with a superior animatronics engineer to found, what is the other one called? There's Chuck E. Cheese Pizza Time Theater.
It's another one of those?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pizza Time Theater. Yeah.
And that one became so much more popular that they ended up bankrupting Chuck E. Cheese and buying them out. And Nolan Bushnell was left with very little. And now his stake in Apple would have been worth like $1 trillion, I think.
It's so wild.
Yeah.
But God bless him. He went for it. And
he did.
Yeah. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I do. So this is my one time I've ever gone viral.
Okay.
My sister had children much younger than the rest of us and was always asking us to babysit. And I, at the time, did not feel fit to babysit. And I was being just selfish. And it took me a long time to finally agree to babysit her kids. And one of them was, you know, 3 or 4. So fairly well beyond the age of like nursing. Mm-hmm. And I decided to play a little trick on my sister while I had her kids in my care. So I told the 3-year-old Kira, sometime when the house is quiet and nothing's going on, just kind of like roll your eyes back into your head and say like mother's milk in the creepiest voice you can imagine. And she thought this was funny. And so she didn't tell anyone. And I assumed that, you know, maybe she forgot about it or maybe she did it. A couple weeks later, my sister calls me and she's really troubled. There was a meeting at her kid's preschool. And apparently this little weird verbal tic I taught Kira mm-hmm. had become a viral hit amongst all the preschoolers. And mm-hmm. And all the parents were really concerned that the kids were like regressing or having some kind of weird Freudian slip. I never told my sister where that particular meme came from, but I did go viral.
Wait, is she finding out now if she listens to this?
Maybe she'll have to. I'll have to hide this one for her.
I love that the scientist yes and is a bit, which is what we call that in Second City. Like you did a bit. One of my favorite, like that term, which is a comedy term, right? This is what you did was a bit. My friend Neil Flynn, who is the janitor in Scrubs, and he was also on a bunch of other stuff.
Oh yeah.
So he's a Second City guy, but he's also an actor, and he went to Steppenwolf. And the late Martha Levy was the artistic director, who I just love. Martha, no sense of humor whatsoever. So Neil would be doing things like talking about his one man carousel. And then she would say, oh, is that one of your lies? And he'd be like, well, technically, I called a bit, but I guess it is a lie.
That's great.
The book is called Playing with Reality, How Games Have Shaped Our World. Kelly Clancy, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
rest of your life from adulthood. No one survives.